5% inflation rate has been high and increased during the the previous 2.5 years, and we are still the PTI government has not increased even 1% or salaries in the last budget.
The protest by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The seventh so-called Ukraine Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, and not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations, we don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the nation's media and political elite are consumed by the impeachment trial of ex-President Donald Trump, talks on a desperately needed and long-delayed major economic stimulus package have been forced on hold. After an economically devastating pandemic year, Main Street has been clamoring for economic aid. President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill has a huge 75% public approval rating. But as Democrats issue more of the exact details, fissures are mounting between their left and right factions. Republicans who want to reduce the stimulus package are being accused of defying public opinion. Discontent is also rising as Biden's proposal backtracks, pulls his support, or reduces a host of economic promises, ending Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and all while many say Main Street needed all of that and more in the world's richest country.
If we're not talking about $2,000 per month with retro pay and also a forgiveness of all mortgages as well as rent, and I don't mean like moratorium where they have to pay it down the line. If you couldn't pay $1,000 a month, then you're not going to be able to pay $5,000 over the course of 5 months to do it. That's just asinine.
There is mounting backlash over Biden's plan to abandon the proposed raising of the minimum wage from $7 to $15 an hour. Such an increase wouldn't just reverse decades of soaring wage inequality, it would spur much-needed economic growth amid the pandemic recession. The federal minimum wage has not been lifted in over a decade, further impoverishing the nation's working poor and lower classes. The gap between campaign promises and what looks like will actually be delivered may explain why a top poll recently showed that 70% of the nation is dissatisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the nation today.
Capitalism needs this to be put on pause. Actually, I mean, you know, my opinion, capitalism needs to be replaced, but capitalism needs to be on pause from the banks on down. And the reality is, if these measures are not done, these drastic measures are not done, then no, America won't heal.
Mid-March is the earliest date the third stimulus is likely to be passed. Reduced unemployment benefits from the modest and also last-minute second stimulus package will expire by April. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front-page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the UK weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Furiza, London.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf visited Moscow for talks with a number of Russian officials on regional and international issues aimed at further cementing the two sides' strategic relations. In a meeting with the chairwoman of Federation Council of Russia, Valentina Matviyenko, Ghalibaf said his visit to Russia has become special since he carries a message from Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This important message is about the region and the world powers and has the meaning that the bilateral relation between Iran and Russia will be strategic and deep for several decades. Iran's leader has also thanked the Russian Federation and China for the fair position on the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the US did not fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
The Iranian official also made it clear that Iran has received nothing from the JCPOA other than sanctions and underlined that Iran will do its best to neutralize unilateral sanctions imposed on the country.
Our goal is to neutralize sanctions, that is, to strengthen our economy through expanding ties with friendly countries that have independence in decision-making.
For her part, chairwoman of the Federation Council of Russia said the visit of Ghalibaf would give fresh impetus to the relations between the two states. She also said that Moscow is eager to expand ties with Iran despite obstacles on this way.
Industry, clean energy, counterterrorism, defense, technology, culture are areas of strategy, and this is where Russia and Iran say they can establish cooperation to counter the U.S. unilateralism as well as their culture of dominance.
This visit is intended to help Russia and Iran find a ground for further cooperation. This will help us to stop the global wave of chaos and lawlessness. This will also pave the way for putting an end to the immoral sanctions on Iran and the Russian Federation.
Iranian Parliament Speaker arrived in Moscow on Sunday at the official invitation of Russia's State Duma at the head of a high-ranking parliamentary delegation. During his visit, he held talks with some senior Russian officials, including Secretary of Security Council of Russia Nikolai Patrushev, on a number of regional and international issues, from terrorism to upcoming international meeting on Syria in the Astana format in Sochi. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iran has officially launched its vaccination program, with the son of Iran's health minister being the first Iranian volunteer to receive the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Doctors, nurses, and medical workers there received the first doses of Russian vaccine. Speaking at a ceremony at Imam Khomeini Hospital, Iran's health minister said Iran has chosen and imported one of the least harmful and less dangerous vaccines.
We have chosen and imported one of the least harmful and less dangerous vaccines after assessing the most credible vaccines available. Iran insisted from the very beginning that it imports a vaccine only if it has already undertaken the third phase of its human trial, while some of the regional countries did not do so.
In a video address, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the vaccination campaign will ensure health of those who receive it.
The fact that the son of the health minister has become a volunteer to receive the first vaccine sends out this message that if officials make decisions about a vaccine and the health ministry approves it, we are all ready to receive it. People should be assured that if a vaccine is imported to the country, all officials trust it. We hope this vaccination campaign will ensure the health of all those who receive imported and domestically made vaccines so that we can take a big step in the fight against COVID-19.
Iran received the first vaccine shipment containing 500,000 doses last week from Russia. It is planned to receive a total of 2 million doses of Sputnik V by the end of March.
The top priority groups of people for vaccination are doctors, nurses and other medical staff working at intensive care units in hospitals. People over 65 and those with chronic diseases will be amongst the second group of people to be vaccinated. The vaccination of doctors and medical personnel is expected to be complete in less than 2 months.
Iran's vaccination campaign comes as the country is working on its two domestically produced vaccines, namely COVID-1 and RazyCovPars, which are at the stage of human trials.
According to Iran's health ministry, the national vaccination program in the country will be completed until the end of the next Iranian calendar year. Saman Kujur, Tehran.
In a press conference, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok announced a major cabinet reshuffle, adding that the new cabinet will focus on economic reforms, peace building, balanced foreign policy, restriction of civilian and military entities, and justice for victims of civil wars in the country.
Our government focuses on a number of issues, particularly economy. We have a unified vision in coping with the current economic crisis. We will work hard to implement Juba peace agreement.
The reshuffle is a part of the government's larger plan to push through the reforms and get foreign finance to overcome an ongoing economic crisis. It follows a peace deal signed in October with some rebel groups. Fighting in Darfur has left at least 300,000 people dead and 2.5 million displaced since 2003. Regarding foreign relations, Hamdok said Sudan's relation will be based on mutual interest, adding that most issues, including relations with Israel, will be decided by the next legislative assembly.
We repeat once again that the issue of normalizing ties with Israel will be decided by the upcoming legislative assembly, and it will decide to accept or reject it.
The reshuffle has created mixed reactions among the public, with many expecting new ways to overcome the current problems.
The ministerial reshaping has been overwhelmed by complacencies. The new ministers are activists with no deep experience, plus comes as the economic situation is very bad.
This government has done nothing. We want a better government that provides us with better services. I'm struggling with poverty and I can't meet my needs.
Sudan's economy was destroyed under previous regime by decades of sanctions, mismanagement and civil war.
Sudan Prime Minister has finally made the long-awaited cabinet reshuffle. But the question is, to what extent the new government will be able to address the chronic economic situation and to improve the living condition of Sudanese people? Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Impeachment lawyers for Donald Trump accused the prosecution of waging a politically motivated witch hunt against the former president, vehemently denying the charge that his words and actions incited the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol as they concluded their sharply partisan defense and prepared for a swift conclusion to the trial. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Sam Levine and Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled Impeachment Trial, Defense Lawyers Argue Trump is Victim of Cancel Culture. Stay with us for more of Sam Levine and Lauren Gambino's article. Impeachment lawyers for Donald Trump accused the prosecution of waging a politically motivated witch hunt against the former president, vehemently denying the charge that his words and actions incited a deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol as they concluded their sharply partisan defense and prepared for a swift conclusion to the trial. Confident that Trump's unprecedented second impeachment trial would again result in acquittal, the defense lawyers channeled the former president's bombastic style and his loose relationship with the facts to denounce the case against him as an unconstitutional act of political vengeance fueled by Democrats' long-standing hatred of their client. They claimed the House managers had grievously mischaracterized Donald Trump's remarks to his followers at a rally on Wednesday, 6th of January, when he exhorted them to fight like hell during a rally just before they marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington and attacked the U.S. Capitol. No thinking person could seriously believe that the president's January 6th speech on the Ellipse was in any way an incitement to violence or insurrection, said Michael Van der Veen, one of Donald Trump's lawyers. At the core of their argument was that Donald Trump's words and actions were protected under the First Amendment. Trump's language, the defense argued, was no different than the heated rhetoric politicians frequently use in American politics today. To make this point, they showed misleadingly edited clips of Democrats, including some senators seated as jurors in the trial, encouraging their supporters to fight in an attempt to portray them as hypocritical. The prosecution has strenuously refuted this contention, arguing that Donald J. Trump's conduct directly incited an insurrection against the nation he had sworn an oath to protect, and therefore did not amount to protected political speech. The defense also sought to portray Donald Trump as the most pro-police, anti-mob rule president this country has ever seen, claiming, despite evidence to the contrary, that he had never condoned violence and noting that he also told the crowd to march peacefully and patriotically during his 6th of January speech. This unprecedented effort is not about Democrats opposing political violence. It's about Democrats trying to disqualify their political opposition. It is constitutional cancel culture, said Michael Van der Veen, a personal injury lawyer. Trump's lawyers used less than 3 of the total 16 hours allotted to open and close their defense of the president. Following their speedy presentation, the Senate proceeded to a period of questioning the prosecution and defense, the conclusion of which cleared the way for closing arguments and a verdict, perhaps as early as next Saturday. The defense's presentation on Friday, 12th of February 2021, came after the 9 House managers, acting as prosecutors, spent 2 days building a methodological case against the former president that retold the insurrection with harrowing new video. In their presentation, they argued the riot was not the result of one incendiary speech, but the culmination of Donald Trump's desperate bid to cling on to power. Crucially, the managers contended Trump betrayed his oath of office by failing to intervene once the siege of Capitol Building of Congress, where both the House and the Senate were in session, began, and that his lack of remorse in the aftermath shows he remains a clear threat to American democracy. The President of the United States did not defend the capital of this country. Stacey Plaskett, a delegate from the Virgin Islands and one of the House managers, told senators on Friday, 12th of February, "It's indefensible." During their presentation on Friday, 12th of February, Donald Trump's attorneys attempted to redirect the responsibility from the former president solely to the people who laid siege to the Capitol building. In a preemptive rebuttal, the managers played video of the insurrectionists shouting at police that they had been invited there by Donald Trump and pointed to several court documents in which rioters charged with criminal offenses have said they were acting at Donald Trump's behest. The defense also sought to recast some of the most damning moments of Trump's presidency, portraying as benign his remarks that there had been very fine people on both sides of a 2017 neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, resisted by counter-protesters. They also defended a December 2020 phone call in which Donald Trump implored the Georgia Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn Joe Biden's victory in that state. The phone call is referenced in the article of impeachment against Donald Trump as part of his brazen campaign to reverse his election defeat. 17 Republican senators would have to join with all the Democrats to find Trump guilty, an unlikely verdict. A conviction would allow the Senate to then vote to disqualify Donald Trump from ever holding future office. His team maintained that the trial was unconstitutional because Donald Trump was no longer in office, even though a majority of senators, including 6 Republicans, rejected that argument after hearing hours of debate on the issue on Tuesday. Bruce Castor, a Pennsylvania former prosecutor serving as one of Donald Trump's attorneys, concluded his case with a grave warning about the consequences of convicting the former president. This trial is about far more than President Trump. It's about silencing and banning the speech the majority doesn't agree with. It's about canceling 75 million Trump voters and criminalizing political viewpoints, Bruce Castor said before resting the defense case on Friday. It's the only existential issue before us. After the defense rested, the senators silently submitted their questions for the prosecution and the defense, leading to a number of heated exchanges and disputed timeline of events. During one contentious back and forth, Donald Trump's lawyer said his remarks at the 6th of January rally were totally appropriate, prompting an impassioned response from Jamie Raskin, the lead House Democratic prosecutor. Violence all over the rallies, the president cheering it on, delighting in it, reveling in it, exulting in it. Come on, Raskin said, how gullible do you think we are? Pressed by multiple senators to elaborate on when Donald Trump first learned of the breach of the Capitol building, Michael Van der Veen said Trump was not aware that Mike Pence's life was in danger when he disparaged his vice president in a tweet just moments after he had been rushed from the Senate chamber. That timeline was thrown into question earlier this week when Senator Tommy Tuberville revealed that he had informed Donald Trump of Mike Pence's evacuation during a phone call as the mob closed in on the Senate. Asked by a senator if the phone call indicated Donald Trump was tolerant of the intimidation of Mike Pence, Michael Van der Veen said it did not and dismissed the conversation as hearsay. But speaking to reporters after the trial adjourned on Friday, Senator Tommy Tuberville, a staunch supporter of Donald Trump, stood by his version of events, though he did not recall precisely what time Donald Trump called. Trump's state of mind as his supporters stormed the Capitol is important to a number of senators weighing whether to convict him or not. On Friday, CNN reported that Donald Trump told House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy during an expletive-laced phone call on 6th of January that the rioters were more upset about the election than the California Republican was. Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler, one of only 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, confirmed the account in a statement on Friday night, likely the eve of the vote. To the patriots who were standing next to the former president as these conversations were happening, or even to the former vice president, she said, if you have something to add here, now would be the time to do it.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm your host, Saeed Pourreza. Straight to our top story. China has banned BBC World News from airing in the country. In a statement published at midnight Friday, China's National Radio and Television Administration criticized BBC reports for not being impartial and fair. China has defended its position, saying if the BBC chooses to be a rumor monger against China, it would have to bear the consequences. The news comes a week after UK media regulator Ofcom stripped Chinese state broadcaster CGTN of its British broadcast license. Ofcom accused the channel of breaching impartiality standards, an allegation China denies. For more on that, I'm joined by political analyst Carlos Martinez. Thank you for coming on. First off, your reaction to this recent flare-up of tensions between China and the UK.
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously the immediate context to this is that CGTN's broadcast license was revoked by Ofcom last week, purportedly on the basis that CGTN is a state broadcaster and answerable to the Chinese government. Well, regardless of what view anyone takes about that rule, we can all see that it's being applied in a selective and discriminatory way. Lots of state broadcasters have Ofcom licenses, including the BBC, national broadcasters from Japan, France, South Korea, and so on. And I think Press TV can probably sympathize with this predicament, having itself been subjected to the same type of discrimination. So really, in revoking the BBC's license, the Chinese authorities are responding in kind. And I think the public
What do you think of the Chinese comment? They have accused the BBC of being, and I quote, a rumor monger against Beijing.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly accurate assessment. You know, BBC's coverage of China has been very biased, particularly in relation to Hong Kong and particularly in relation to Xinjiang. For example, the BBC recently featured a very long expose article about human rights abuses being perpetrated against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. But this expose was based almost exclusively on documents put together by some sources that have got basically no credibility whatsoever. First, there's Adrian Zenz, who's this sort of independent, far-right, anti-China crusader and a senior fellow at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, whose research methods are dubious to say the least. And the other big source is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is a government think tank funded by the US State Department, funded by various arms manufacturers. So China's well within its rights to complain about the BBC's lack of objectivity and credibility.
Other than the BBC's coverage of Hong Kong, if we were to go back and to look at what has led to this flare-up in tensions between the two sides, anything else that you can think of? Because they said they were going to hit the reset button in terms of their relations, especially in the post-Brexit world. What did go wrong?
Yeah, pressing the reset button would be a correct and necessary thing to do. And in terms of the interests of the British people and in terms of humanity as a whole, in terms of the wider context of the new Cold War, would be a very sensible thing. Unfortunately, tensions between the UK and China have only ramped up over the last year or two. Obviously, in the last few weeks, we've had the dispatch of British Navy warships to the South China Sea in a clear statement of support for NATO and the US's China encirclement strategy, which is in itself an irresponsible and hostile act and a threat to peace. And I wonder what the British public's response would be if Chinese warships were to enter British waters. I suspect not very favorable. Meanwhile, a few months ago, you had Britain essentially taking orders from Mike Pompeo to remove Huawei from Britain's 5G infrastructure on spurious security grounds. And then, of course, we've got the interference in China's internal affairs by offering residency to Hong Kong's BNO passport holders, which is essentially making a statement in support of an anti-China separatist movement in Hong Kong, which itself, up till 1997, was a British colony run on more or less apartheid and highly anti-democratic lines. So, you know, we've got a state of tensions, which is escalating.
Right.
And it would be very wise for the British authorities to, as you put it, hit that reset button.
All right. Carlos Martinez, political analyst. Thanks for your input. Moving on now. At least 20 Israelis, including individuals from the weapons industry, are under investigation over illegal weapon sales to an unspecified Asian country. Israeli officials say the suspects developed, manufactured, tested, and sold suicide drones, also known as kamikaze drones, to the unnamed country. The news comes less than 2 weeks after the announcement of 3 sales of these kinds of weapons by the Israeli arms industry to unnamed Asian countries. Russia's UN delegation has clashed with Western ambassadors at a virtual meeting of the world body in New York.
Over the last 6 years, we've had 2 very important questions which Kiev still hasn't answered. How exactly do they intend to resolve the conflict? And how do they envisage the future special status of the Donbas region within Ukraine?
The United States reaffirms its unwavering commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. We will never recognize Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea.
Kiev's began its use of force shelling residential areas by its army, which continues to this day. How can the people of Donbas have any connection with Ukraine?
The people of Crimea voted to rejoin Russia in a referendum in 2014. Kiev ignored the decision and sent in troops, leading to clashes with Russian-backed separatists. So far, more than 14,000 people have been killed in the conflict. Russia says it's prepared to break off relations with the European Union if the bloc imposes any more sanctions on Moscow. The UK and EU have introduced targeted sanctions on Russia over Alexei Navalny, the country's leading far-right opposition figure. The EU is now considering additional measures over his recent jail sentence, a move lauded by Navalny's allies.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has made it very clear Russia will not tolerate the UK and EU interfering in its internal affairs. A week after Moscow expelled diplomats from Sweden, Poland and Germany, accusing them of attending a rally in support of opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Lavrov warned against any further provocations.
We do not want to isolate ourselves from the world, but we must be ready for this. If you want peace, prepare for war.
Navalny recently returned to Russia from Berlin, where he was recovering from a nerve gas poisoning. Accused of violating the terms of his parole in an embezzlement case dating back to 2014, he was arrested upon arrival and handed a 2.5-year jail sentence. And now he is in court again, facing charges of slandering a war veteran who appeared in a clip broadcast on Russia Today. It promoted constitutional reforms, which would extend President Vladimir Putin's rule. In a tweet, Navalny branded the war veteran and the others in the clip traitors, but he himself is now facing the same accusation. His allies are urging the EU to impose fresh sanctions on Moscow, which the Kremlin says is nothing less than betrayal.
The only plausible explanation for Navalny actually turning on the Russian establishment is that he's basically a paid operative. I mean, we've seen this time and time again. Juan Guaido in Venezuela is one example. We've seen even the Green movement in Iran arguably is possibly another example of it. But of course, the Western governments have a habit of creating false flags, psychological operations, color revolutions. This is part of the permanent goodie bag and package that comes with Western foreign policy. So Russia is no different.
The bloc's foreign ministers will debate possible sanctions against the Kremlin on February 22nd. France and Germany are pushing for travel bans and asset freezes on Putin's allies, possibly as soon as this month. Yanka Rahimi, London.
Moving away from Russia now, millions continue to celebrate the measures implemented by U.S. President Joe Biden. But there is one promise Joe Biden has yet to fulfill, directly tied to criticisms of past policies he pioneered. Will Joe Biden keep his word to Black America? Richard Sedan raises that question in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
With the world still reveling at the removal of Donald Trump from the White House, people have been celebrating the election of President Joe Biden. Since the election race began, the Democrats and the liberal media attempted to present Biden as a decent-minded, all-American libertarian sent down from on high to cure Americans' wounded divides. But is this really the case? Well, in the interest of fairness, it's only right to look at his early actions since taking office and his record as a senator. Let's take a look. In his first few hours in office, Joe Biden immediately signed a number of executive orders taking action on a range of issues. They included reversing Trump's Muslim travel ban, halting plans for the controversial Keystone oil pipeline, allowing transgender people to join the US military, stopping the Mexican border wall construction, rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, taking action over the coronavirus pandemic, which under Donald Trump spiraled out of control. These measures and the selection of former Attorney General Kamala Harris as Biden's vice president led liberals around the world to hail Biden as a progressive, woke president of the people. However, despite this, there are critical issues and promises glaringly absent from Joe Biden's magic bucket list of early executive orders. And what's missing from the list has been completely drowned out in the wave of uncritical support for Biden. Because many people want to forget that during his decades-long career, Joe Biden consistently pushed policies and rhetoric that devastated Black American communities. Joe Biden's 94 crime bill, something which the liberal media have remained quiet on, is widely viewed as paving the way for mass incarceration in the United States, mass incarceration which overwhelmingly impacts Black people. Not only that, but the language used by Biden in pushing the bill through was remarkably similar to the racially charged super predator myth pushed by the Clintons, who wanted to play up to racial stereotypes about Black people.
We have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994.
Yes, that crime bill signed by Hillary's husband, Bill, with none other than Joe Biden standing behind him, clapping for a bill which would send thousands of Black people unjustly to prison. Now, back to the all-American racist language that made the crime bill possible.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators.
Super predators? Did she mean? No, she meant. And everyone knows this is the cunning racist language of the post-Reagan era. Now, back to President Biden. Surely Biden didn't play this game too, did he?
It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they're about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. So I don't want to ask, what made them do this? They must be taken off the street. That's number one. There's a consensus on that. Unless we do something about that cadre of young people, tens of thousands of them, born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, without any structure, without any conscience developing, because they literally, I yield myself three more minutes, because they literally have not been socialized.
Born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, and without conscience, who exactly is Biden stereotyping here, and which audience is he playing to? Still, maybe we're wrong. Biden can't be racist. After all, he did select Kamala Harris as his vice president. And a long time has passed since 1994. It's not like he's made any racist statements since then, surely.
Unlike the African-American community, with notable exceptions, the Latino community is an incredibly diverse community with incredibly different attitudes about different things.
Wait, so all Black Americans think in the same way? Well, all right, maybe that was a slip of the tongue by President Biden. Surely, especially in the election campaign, Biden wouldn't make any more sweeping generalizations about Black people, right?
It's a long way until November. We got more questions.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't Black.
Well, all right, so maybe he did. But at least despite these comments, Biden has now begun to make amends to reform the system he created. Right? wrong. According to activists, reducing the footprint of federal prisons will not reduce mass incarceration in any significant way. It will simply push prisoners to public prisons. It will do nothing to end the systematic injustice which sees black people imprisoned in disproportionately higher numbers for crimes which others are not, in what is now known as a modern form of slavery. Joe Biden made a promise when he was elected.
Especially for those moments, and especially for those moments where this campaign was at its lowest ebb, the African-American community stood up again for me.
But given his track record, do we really expect Biden to change? So many other communities have seen their concerns prioritized by Biden, and as of yet, he has taken no serious action on policing or mass incarceration. Has Biden really changed? Or is he the same Biden who pushed through the 94 crime bill?
Portugal's parliament has voted to extend the country's state of emergency to the beginning of March, allowing the government to keep the current national lockdown in place for the rest of this month.
It's all very clear. We must leave spring without another summer and autumn under threat in terms of lives, health, economy and society. We must ensure that Easter in early April won't be a cause for more months similar to the past weeks.
When the COVID-19 pandemic reached Europe, Portugal was praised for its swift reaction, while other countries were overwhelmed. Now it's the world's worst per capita rate of coronavirus cases and deaths. With its health service overwhelmed, the desperate nation has asked Germany for medical help. By Sunday last week, only 7 intensive care beds had been left in the entire country.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, the comments by Kehinde Andrews, a black studies professor, who says the UK was built on racism and compared Winston Churchill to Hitler. Let's see how those comments have gone down in this country with Richard Sudan. Richard, take it away.
Absolutely, Saeed, and good to see you. So there's been a massive debate which has erupted online concerning Winston Churchill, which is dubbed, or who is dubbed rather, as Britain's greatest ever Briton. But I think here the reality for many is if you're born in Britain and you're educated in Britain like I was, you would have had a very one-sided view of history and Churchill when you went to school. But I think the more kind of serious intellectual, internationalist, scholarly view put forward by Mr. Kehinde Andrews really understands that Britain's legacy has a much different reputation around the world than it does in Britain, because of course Britain colonized and committed genocide in Africa, Asia, all around the world, and actually much of that colonization and genocide was predicated on the idea that white Europeans are of a superior race. And Churchill himself actually talked about this idea himself. It's on the historical record that he believed white people were a superior race. You know, this is a matter of historical fact, and facts simply don't care about people's feelings. You know, why would we not listen to the historical views from Professor Kehinde Andrews compared to, say, the likes of the Daily Mail, which platforms people, or did platform people, like Katie Hopkins, etc., etc.? I think the truth about Britain is what it is, and if you want to glorify Churchill, Britain and the Empire and Britannia ruling the waves, you have to really acknowledge the whole picture.
All right, and then what I find fascinating is when he appears on British television, he constantly gets interrupted and they won't even let him finish his sentence. Probably, you know, lends a lot of support to the veracity of the arguments that he's bringing. Maybe tell us what Twitter users have been saying about the professor and what he's been saying.
So let's go to decolonize the curriculum that says Galton's eugenics. We know Churchill firmly believed in the ideology, and of course he did. Nessa tweets to say Britain as a nation oppressed and oppressed the messed up island for centuries isn't racist. Churchill had almost the same views as Hitler. What about him is worthy of praise. Churchill was responsible for genocide too. And we have an interesting reaction here and a telling one from Nigel Farage. Farage tweeted, a woke school has banned Winston Churchill because he promoted racism and inequality. Apparently, he also unfairly imprisoned and tortured many. This rewriting of history in our education system is dangerous. I highlighted this because many would say, Saeed, Farage is a proto-fascist or certainly a racist. Many would say he led a very racist campaign. So perhaps it's not surprising that Nigel Farage would endorse the factual racism of Winston Churchill.
All right, Richard, and while we're still talking about racism, tell us what the British Home Secretary has been saying about the Black Lives Matter protests against racial injustice in 2020.
Well, shock, horror, hold on to your seat. Priti Patel labeled Black Lives Matter as, quote, dreadful. But to me, Saeed, this didn't really surprise me because we learned from the Windrush scandal that Priti Patel already evidently doesn't believe that Black Lives Matter, because that scandal directly impacted communities, almost exclusively black, dealing with major injustices, wrongful, unlawful deportations, in some instances leading to death. And Priti Patel has done nothing to implement the findings of the Windrush review by Wendy Williams, despite the fact she promised she would. But also, one more quick point, Saeed. I think Priti Patel may have aspirations to be Prime Minister. Boris Johnson is on the record as calling black people pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. So maybe Priti Patel wants to appeal to Boris Johnson's voter base in order to have political aspirations. That's what some people are saying, Saeed.
Wow. Well, let's hear some other people's view on this as well.
I want to go to Joe Plumstead first, who says, Priti Patel hits out at the dreadful Black Lives Matter protest. What an awful human being. I'm so sick of this level of ignorance. Tom tweets, Patel playing the populist, nationalist, xenophobic card again. Racist lappet wrapped in a union flag. Covert support for the ultra-nationalist, xenophobes or worse. And finally, if we have time, Diane Abbott MP tweeted, so the Home Secretary continues in her mission to bring communities together. A very tongue-in-cheek, sarcastic tweet there from Diane Abbott.
And she is definitely not woke, Richard, is she?
I think many would say, Saeed, she's the polar opposite and perhaps antithesis of woke. And I mean, to come out with a statement like this, to back up many of her policies, to be fair to Patel, the, you know, many of these scandals erupted before her tenure, but many would also say she certainly perpetuated racist policies and arguably made it worse since her time as Home Secretary.
All right, Richard Sedan with those stories. Richard, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The revolution came and brought full political independence for the country. That is to say, today in this vast world, there is not even a single power among the superpowers which can claim its will has the slightest effect on the will of the government officials or the Iranian nation. In particular, this issue, namely resistance, independence, political dignity, is the most attractive things for nations. When you notice that nations feel respect for the Iranian nation, you should pay attention to the fact that a major portion of this respect is related to our political independence. Monarchy was a system of government before the revolution. Democracy is the opposite of monarchy. In a monarchy, the people do not have any role in government. In a democracy, the people are in charge of everything. Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah. Government was hereditary before the revolution. Rulers used to determine their successors before they died. That is to say, the people had no role in government. Whether they liked it or not, they had no choice but to accept their government. Thanks to the revolution, the people can now choose their government. The taste and will of the people play a determining role. Before the revolution, the system of government was security-based dictatorship. Harsh and dark dictatorship. I remember that a friend of mine came to Mashhad from Pakistan to see me. He had entered the country illegally. He said that once he was sitting in a park with his friends and that they were reading a political leaflet in the park. I was surprised. Reading a political leaflet in a park? Is such a thing possible? I could not imagine that somebody could walk in the street with a political leaflet in his pocket. A leaflet which contains a few criticisms of the government. This was how the security-based dictatorship of that time was like. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Africans have for decades been used for unethical clinical trials by large Western pharmaceutical companies in clear violation of their basic human rights. There have been many incidents of unethical experimentation, clinical trials lacking properly informed consent, and forced medical procedures in Africa. The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Trovan in Nigeria is one of the examples. One of the victims harmed during a 1996 experiment in Nigeria by the US pharmaceutical giant Pfizer elaborates on her suffering.